Hi, I'm John Hope Bryant, host of Money and Wealth on the Black Effect Podcast Network. I'm an entrepreneur and a businessman. Now, every Thursday, my newest venture is educating you on how to win financially. Even better, I'm going to teach it in a way that, well, you can understand. I'm going to meet you where you are and take you where you need to be. We all might have different starting points and end goals, but as long as we have the desire to acquire financial freedom, it can be done. Listen to Money and Wealth with John Hope Bryant every Thursday on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Rachel Levis, host of the new podcast, Rachel Goes Rogue. This podcast is about choosing my own path and standing in my power. I have been involved with one of the biggest scandals in reality television history. We're going to get into all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. I've been keeping secrets for far too long, and I just want to come clean. Listen to Rachel Goes Rogue on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On June 23, 1973, a young woman was returning to her apartment in Boston when an assailant grabbed her from behind, forced his way into the building, and dragged her upstairs. During a struggle that culminated in a rape, the young woman managed to stab her attacker in the shoulder with a kitchen knife. However, the encounter was not over. The assailant paraded her, bruised and bloodied, through the streets of Boston for nearly six more hours. On a bus, to a restaurant, and even spoke to some of his friends. Eventually, she escaped to a Roxbury firehouse where one of the firefighters scared off the assailant. Seminal fluid was collected at the hospital, and the survivor described the assailant as black, 5'10", and 160 pounds. She also recalled that the assailant had mentioned his recent release from Concord Correctional. When shown 11 photographs of men who had recently been released, she chose Tyrone Clark. Even though Tyrone was only 5'7 and 135 pounds, five other witnesses chose Tyrone as well. But this is wrongful conviction.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. The man we're interviewing today, Tyrone Clark, served over 48 years in prison for a crime he had absolutely nothing to do with. The story is unfathomable, but every part of it is true. So before I introduce Mr. Clark to you now, I'm going to introduce his attorney, Neil Raphael. Thanks for being here on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Tyrone Clark, man, I'm so happy and honored that you're here, and I'm looking forward to sharing your story with the world.
Thank you.
So, Tyrone, before we talk about the crime itself, which is a horrible crime that you had nothing to do with, again, I'm going to point that out, your life wasn't easy from the get-go, right? Can you tell us about growing up in the, you were born in the 50s, right? Early, mid-50s.
Yeah, I'm originally from Reidsville, North Carolina. And I came to Boston with my mother when I was a baby. It was like nine of us at the time. I came up like a very poor background. We was on welfare. We all basically like slept in the same bed. All of us tried to struggle the best way we can to get food, clothes. My father tried to do what he can by robbing banks and stuff like that. But he went away for a long time, so I didn't really get to know my father that well, because he was in prison. So my mother was just on her own trying to raise us and stuff. And I got taken away from her. They all raided the house and stuff, and they just separated all of us from my mother.
So you went into foster care?
Not just one foster home. I bounced through a few foster homes. I went through one that was abusive because I wet the bed. So I tried to escape when they found me. I didn't know where all my other brothers and sisters went. My mother, she had a breakdown. She went to a mental institution. So, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time with my family, get to know them the way I'm supposed to know them, like a family, had good times with them. Never really had Christmas, all the good holidays and stuff like that.
Well, you never really had any chance to be a kid, to have a decent childhood at all. And you really didn't have much of a shot at life from the beginning. Too many kids go through similar experiences. We really should be able to do better. And we're going to get into the crime itself. You had some juvenile delinquencies, which are understandable. You're trying to make ends meet. And anybody who hasn't walked a mile in your shoes probably can't judge you for those either. These were robberies and things like that. But those probably had the effect of putting you on the radar of the police when this very serious crime took place on Saturday, June 23rd of 1973. And I'm just going to describe the crime. In the afternoon, around 3 o'clock, a young woman was returning to her apartment on Park Drive in Boston from a shopping trip. She approached the door to her building, and an attacker grabbed her from behind and went with her into the vestibule of her building. He struck her and forced her to give him the little money she had, about $30. And then he forced her upstairs to her apartment, raped her, beat her, and dragged her through the city in a 6.5 hour saga. He took her on a bus, forced her to eat a meal with him at a little Spanish restaurant. She had her speak to some of his friends. She was basically kidnapped, right? All the while she tried to get somebody to help with her face bruised and bloody, and nobody helped her until she finally escaped into a Roxbury firehouse. The assailant tried to follow her in, but then he ran away when the fireman said that he was going to call the cops.
She initially looked through a photo lineup book of 100 to 150 photos and wasn't able to identify anybody. During the assault, the individual had mentioned that he or his brother had just been recently released from Concord. And so this next subsequent day, they showed her 10 or 15 photos of individuals who had been recently released from Concord. Now, Tyrone had some juvenile offenses and he had been in Concord Reformatory School. And so he was put into that photo lineup. And as a result, she identified Tyrone as being her assailant.
And of course, he was black and she was white, right? So it's a cross-racial identification. This is a good time to point out that in study after study, it has been proven that cross-racial identification, even in a case like this, where the victim spent such a long time with her attacker in daylight, cross-racial identification has been proven to be less accurate than guessing. Tyrone didn't match the physical description either, right? She described the assailant, though, as 5'10", about 160 pounds, and Tyrone was only 5'7", 135 pounds. So that's a pretty big discrepancy there.
Subsequently, the four firefighters who were at the firehouse that evening identified Tyrone as being the assailant as well. And then you mentioned that she had visited a restaurant, and the waiter identified Tyrone as being the assailant.
And we're not sure what happened during these other five identification procedures, but it's possible the police may have been suggestive toward the photo that the victim had chosen.
There was no physical evidence indicating that Tyrone had been the assailant. There was no fingerprints. There was nothing at the scene reflecting that Tyrone had been there. She had testified that she had stabbed the individual with a knife in the back during the assault, and Tyrone didn't have any sort of markings on his back.
She couldn't be mistaken about the idea that she stabbed someone, right? And to her credit, she fought back, right? But if she stabbed him, where did the stab wound go? Somebody was walking around with a stab wound and some bloody clothes, and it wasn't him. So they should have said, hey, we got to keep looking because this guy doesn't have a stab wound. Am I missing something here?
No.
Did they do a rape kit?
They did take the semen sample at the hospital, but they didn't preserve it, unfortunately. And when I first started working on the case in 2002, that was the first thing we tried to locate, was the rape kit from the hospital, or the quote-unquote semen sample, and they were not able to locate it.
So they had the evidence. Had they really wanted to do a proper investigation, they could have, even with the primitive technology they had 50 years ago in 1973, they may have been able to eliminate him.
And then the other thing that stood out to me is that this crime didn't happen in 20 minutes. This took place over 6 hours. And you would think there would be some sort of fingerprint evidence, either in the apartment, at the restaurant, or somewhere along the scene of the crime. They were on a bus. But there was never any physical evidence that linked Tyrone at all to this crime.
They said I was the perpetrator. They didn't do no real search background or real thorough investigation. They just grabbed me off the street.
And Tyrone, you were arrested, I believe, 2 days after this crime happened. So you wouldn't have had time for this stab wound to heal. So it's not like this was months and months later. So am I right? You were arrested 2 days after the crime?
When I was released from Concord Correctional Center, I was 18 years old. I was in a halfway house. The night watchman came upstairs and told me that the Boston police want to talk to me. When I came downstairs, they asked me questions about where I was at in this certain time and told me, take my shirt off. Can we look at your body? And I said, yeah. I said, what's going on, man? I was shocked. I said, I didn't know what was, the hell was going on, man. They said, it was reported that you raped a woman. I said, what? I said, no, man. I said, you got the wrong person. I said, I'm not no rapist, man, like that. They told me to turn around and stuff, and they looked at me and stuff. And next thing, they cuffed me up and took me from the halfway house, brought me to headquarters and booked me. They looked at me in the police station, too. Like I said, I didn't know what they was looking for until my public defender was telling me that the person was stabbed and no concern that this woman got raped and they was looking for knife wounds. So when they searched me, there was nothing on my body. So I was taken away, put in to a county jail, Child Street Jail, the worstest jail in Massachusetts, where a person like at my age that went there, I could have got killed, could have got raped. I was scared, you know, so I stayed in that county jail for at least about like a year before I went to trial.
Tyrone presented evidence at trial of alibis, two alibis for the time period, because this was a lengthy crime. It took place during the day. So Tyrone was at a party for part of the proceeding and was also at a friend's apartment for part of the proceeding. And his friends testified that he was with them.
My mother, my witnesses, everybody was in court, testified and stuff like this about my whereabouts and stuff. And then I had about like six witnesses, Neil, testified against me.
You had six IDs against you, the victim, the four firefighters, and the restaurant server.
Yeah, I heard all this stuff, man. And I was like, wow, man, why somebody do this to me? I said, I'm not none of this, what they saying I am. And all these people lying on me, saying that they see me with this lady. I ain't never ever seen any of these people, Jason, man. It's just like, I seem like I woke up to some type of nightmare. And then I had all white jewelry.
I mean, even with the fact that you had this eyewitness identification, there's such powerful exculpatory evidence that at least any competent legal mind would be able to mount some sort of a defense. How did they end up getting away with having an all-white jury?
Tyrone's attorney, he was still alive when I first started handling the case, and I never really got into it with him why the jury pool was constituted the way it was. I do think because it was the 1970s in Boston, there was a lot of racism back then, obviously, with the busing crisis and other things that were happening in the city, that because of that jury pool and because all of Tyrone's witnesses were minorities and all of the state's witnesses were white, that Tyrone faced a serious uphill battle. Tyrone's attorney, he said, Neil, after the opening statement, given the horrific nature of the crime and given the jury pool, they looked at Tyrone like he was the devil.
So predictably, on January 24th of 1974, a Suffolk County jury convicted you, Tyrone, of rape, robbery, and kidnapping, and you were sentenced to life in prison, as well as other sentences that they threw on top of that.
My mother, man, she was young at the time. She was so hurt that they sentenced me to life in prison. 25 to 35 on and after in the 8th and 10th concurrent. My mother was so hurt and broke down. Next thing you know, they just took me away and took and sent me up to Walpole State Prison at the age of 18, man.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Laura Vanderkam. I'm a mother of five, an author, journalist, and speaker.
And I'm Sarah Hart Unger, a mother of three, practicing physician, writer, and course creator. We are two working parents who love our careers and our families.
On the Best of Both Worlds podcast each week, we share stories of how real women manage work, family, and time for fun.
We talk all things planning, time management, organization, and more. We share what's worked for us and our listeners as we're building our careers and raising our families. We're here to cheer you on as you figure out how to make your days even more amazing.
From figuring out childcare to mapping out long-term career goals, we want you to get the most out of life.
Listen to Best of Both Worlds every Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
History is beautiful, brutal, and often ridiculous. Join me, Ben Bullen.
And me, Noel Brown, as we dive into some of the strangest stories from across the span of human civilization in Ridiculous History.
Whether we're exploring the accidental invention of hold music,
or how people used to rent pineapples,
why British lawyers still wear those weird wigs,
or that time that Russian hipsters made records out of x-rays?
True story. Or that time Abraham Lincoln was an amateur wrestler.
Boy, that guy had some reach, huh? And don't forget the history of curling,
which is an actual sport.
Join us to hear the many ways history can be oh so ridiculous.
Listen to Ridiculous History on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your favorite shows.
I came from a family, everybody been to jail. My older brother was in prison too. When I got to Walpole in 1973, it was a news article. Everybody seen it. My older brother, he knew a lot of guys upstate. He sent a letter up to Walpole State Prison, told some of his friends, yo, my brother, man, is sentenced, man, something he didn't do. When they asked him, would they look out for me and stuff? And so when I got there, they snatched me as I got at the door and stuff. So they took me to their block and stuff. They looked out for me, gave me canteen, stuff that I needed. I didn't take no shit from nobody, you know what I'm saying? I learned how to box in prison. I put in my own work, what they call putting your own work, protect myself to survive the best way I can. I don't even know how I made it, but I made it, you know, with the grace of God. And I went to parole board and hearings and stuff. I kept getting denied because I maintained my innocence. I had a lot of letdowns and stuff over the years. And I found a lawyer, man, by the name of Barry Sheck with Innocent Project. I wrote to him. I told him about my case, and he says, oh, we really don't handle Massachusetts cases and stuff, but I can refer you to the New England Innocent Project in Massachusetts. So he did that, and they gave me an attorney, and you're talking to him right now.
Neil began working on the case from two angles. At the time, it was 2002, so DNA testing was available. While pursuing biological evidence to support the claims of actual innocence, Neil also fought for Tyrone's immediate release. Due to the guidelines for parole in 1974, as well as the subsequent sentences after the rape, that route was unusual.
So Tyrone was sentenced to life on the rape, and he was sentenced to 25 to 30 on the robbery and concurrently 8 on the kidnapping. So in 1988, on the rape, Tyrone was paroled. Then he started serving his sentence from the robbery and the kidnapping. In 2003, Tyrone called me and said, I've got this letter from the parole board indicating that his 1988 parole had been reversed. In 2002 or 2003, for cases that were very old, they started aggregating sentences for the purposes of parole. So they decided for Tyrone's case, because he was sentenced to life on the rape and 30 on the robbery and concurrently 8 on the kidnappings, they were going to aggregate and have one parole hearing. But the problem was Tyrone had already been paroled in 1988 and they didn't want to release him. So what they ended up doing was, quote unquote, reversing his parole without a hearing or a lawyer being present. So in 2003, I sued the parole board on Tyrone's behalf, basically arguing that that was a constitutional violation. We had a hearing and the judge told them they were going to lose. And so we settled Tyrone's civil action against the parole board. And so he was essentially released because with good time, he had served his concurrent sentences of the robbery and the kidnapping, but he's on his 88 parole, on his life sentence.
So now you're on the streets for the first time in 30 years. Everything looks very different. I mean, imagine from 73 to 2005, everything has changed. Where did you go? What did you do? How did you survive?
My parole officer found me a sober house in Boston. So I stayed there. Then I applied for Boston Housing Authority. And I lived in a room in the south end of Boston. They had me going to sex offender program. I went through hurdles, man. After coming out of prison, I didn't know nowhere to go to get clothes. I didn't know anything. I wasn't in a good space, man. My triggers kicked in. I know how to hustle. So I ended up shoplifting. And I stole some clothing items, violating my parole. I still today regret what I did. I got arrested, kept me for 18 years back behind the walls for a shoplift.
Yeah, and that's 18 years of taxpayers paying probably at least well over $1 million to keep you behind bars for stealing $400 worth of clothes.
He had pled no contest and they revoked his parole. We would try to fight it at the parole board hearing, but because we had sued them, they were not interested in giving him any sort of parole.
While this strained relationship with the parole board did not bode well for any future appearances, there was still Tyrone's actual innocence claim. Although there were six identifications, they were cross-racial and likely suggestive processes. Tyrone didn't match the description, no physical evidence tied him to the scene, no fingerprints matched him, and if they had, they would have used it. He had multiple alibi witnesses as well, and in the 2000s, DNA testing was evolving rapidly.
So Massachusetts had passed a post-conviction DNA testing statute. And when I had worked on the case in early 2002, 2003, we had tried to locate the semen sample that had been left at the hospital. There were male socks that had been left at the scene and a bloody towel. We hadn't been able to locate anything, any physical evidence. And the case had hit a roadblock. But then in the appellate file of the Suffolk County District Attorney, we were able to locate the knife. And so Tyrone asked if I would file a motion under that statute for DNA testing, which was eventually granted. The first round of testing was inconclusive. And at that point, because this case was primarily an identification case, we had started working with CPCS and an attorney named Lisa Cavanaugh.
CPCS, or Committee for Public Counsel Services, is long for public defender in Massachusetts. And Lisa Cavanaugh spearheaded an initiative within the office to look into innocence cases.
In around 2015, 16, I started working with a lawyer, Jeff Harris. My presumption was that the Commonwealth had been in contact with the victim because that's their legal obligation. And Jeff reached out to the victim. And as a result of those conversations, it came out that she had real questions about whether her identification of Tyrone was accurate.
So when I heard all this good news and stuff, man, I was like, wow, man, this is great, man. There's light at the tunnel. I think I'm going to go home. I really felt as though that she searched for so many years. You know, she was hidden for so many years. Her conscience made her come forward. And what happened was she went to Jennifer Thompson.
Jennifer Thompson survived a rape in which she studied her attacker's face. Yet, was also led to identify the wrong man, Ronald Cotton. I had the honor of interviewing both of them together, and we're going to have that incredible episode linked in the episode description.
Jennifer Thompson told the lady in my case, don't be afraid to tell your story. You know, go public with it. She went on the radio. She went on TV.
Back in 2019, the victim wrote letters to the Massachusetts Parole Board and the court, saying that she believed that she could have identified the wrong man. She said that she was worried that she, the four firemen, and the server at the restaurant picked the same person because he looked like the assailant without actually being the assailant, and that there were other issues that may have tainted the identification process. In her letter to the parole board, she wrote, this is in 2019, quote, if Tyrone Clark were to be tried today, given the lack of physical evidence linking him to the crime, I doubt that he would be convicted. I fear that he may also be a victim, end quote.
J.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Laura Vanderkam. I'm a mother of five, an author, journalist, and speaker.
And I'm Sarah Hart Unger, a mother of three, practicing physician, writer, and course creator. We are two working parents who love our careers and our families.
On the Best of Both Worlds podcast each week, we share stories of how real women manage work, family, and time for fun.
We talk all things planning, time management, organization, and more. We share what's worked for us and our listeners as we're building our careers and raising our families. We're here to cheer you on as you figure out how to make your days even more amazing.
From figuring out childcare to mapping out long-term career goals, we want you to get the most out of life.
Listen to Best of Both Worlds every Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
History is beautiful, brutal, and often ridiculous. Join me, Ben Bullen.
And me, Noel Brown, as we dive into some of the strangest stories from across the span of human civilization in Ridiculous History.
Whether we're exploring the accidental invention of hold music,
or how people used to rent pineapples,
why British lawyers still wear those weird wigs,
or that time that Russian hipsters made records out of x-rays?
True story. Or that time Abraham Lincoln was an amateur wrestler.
Boy, that guy had some reach, huh? And don't forget the history of curling,
which is an actual sport.
Join us to hear the many ways history can be oh so ridiculous.
Listen to Ridiculous History on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your favorite shows.
When I heard that she was doing all this stuff and I was in prison and guys was calling me, Tyrone, you on TV, man. All the victim is talking about you, man. Oh, Tyrone, you're going to get out of prison, man. You know, I was happy, you know what I mean? And, you know what I'm saying, when she came forward the way she did with the DA's office and all these people, you know, wrote stories, and this lady is an inspiration. It wasn't her fault. This could have happened to anybody, what happened to me. I appreciate this lady for what she did. It wasn't for her still alive that came forward. I would have died in prison.
With the support of the victim, Tyrone's attorney sought subsequent DNA testing, with the latest methods revealing a male profile on the knife that simply did not match Tyrone. And they filed a motion for a new trial in 2020.
Even after the victim had come forward, even after the DNA issue had been explored, even after Jeff primarily had done a lot of work on witness identifications, the motion for new trial was filed in 2020. It was denied. It was up on appeal. And then subsequently, they changed their mind for some reason. And they agreed that they would assent to a motion to vacate the rape conviction on the basis that they had failed to preserve the semen sample that the hospital had drawn on the night of the crime.
Wait, out of the kindness of their hearts?
Very good question.
I mean, this kind of thing just doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, it was very, very, very strange because the Boston police hadn't done their job and preserved it. They then agreed to, as a self-imposed punishment for the Brady violation, agreed to assent to the motion to vacate his sentence.
That's incredible news.
So then subsequent to that, I was still working on the case. Jeff Harris needed to back off the case. So we secured another lawyer by the name of Ed Gaffney because I was no longer practicing criminal law. I mean, Tyrone was my last criminal case. So Ed filed a motion for new trial based on the robbery and the kidnapping charges in August of 2023. The judge agreed to vacate those charges. The Commonwealth opposed that motion, and the judge disregarded their arguments and said, well, if you agreed to essentially vacate the rape charge, why are you still have him responsible for the robbery and kidnapping? And the judge vacated those charges. And then the Commonwealth decided to null pros, meaning they're not going forward with the prosecution. And then so Tyrone was officially exonerated of all of these charges.
But Tyrone was awaiting those 2023 proceedings from the outside after his release following the vacature of his rape conviction back in November 2021.
I felt great when I got the news I was being released. The day that I got out, man, it was, I think it was around Thanksgiving now.
Yeah, it was.
I get a phone call saying, Tyrone, man, you're being released from prison. I said, what? He said, yeah, I'm coming to pick you up. Like that. That's my attorney, Jeff Harris. Great guy. You know, he really fought real hard in the criminal matter. I said, oh, yeah. He said, yes, yeah. You know what I'm saying? Just be ready. So now when I go downstairs, the booking, all the officers was glad. They was telling me they read about me in the paper. You know, they were happy for me. Now when I went downstairs, I went out the door. So I got in the car. My lawyer, Jeff Harris, he showed me on the phone. He said, look at all these people raising money for you, man. I didn't know anything about no GoFundMe or any of that stuff. I never even know these people to get the chance to thank them for generosity or support that they giving me money to try to help me get on my feet. But the money that was raised, because I didn't have nowhere to go, I slept in hotels.
So one of the bigger issues, obviously, is because he doesn't have a credit history or an employment history or an ID, it's very difficult to find someone like that housing. And so for a significant period of time, he had to stay in hotels.
So that GoFundMe burnt out.
And we're going to link to that GoFundMe for Tyrone in the episode description so you can help him get to where he needs to be, get some comfort in his life, long overdue. And because these civil cases take forever, they shouldn't, but they do. They take years and years. So I hope that our audience will be generous in supporting.
I got this place through no credit. It took me a long time to even find a place. Neil will tell you, you know, like I said, I lived in hotels. Some of them treated me okay, but then again, some, you know, I went through a little, I'm not even going to get into it. Neil know what I'm talking about.
Tyrone was letting homeless people shower in his hotel and he got in trouble for doing that. And so when that happened, I had to explain to Tyrone that the hotels generally don't like that, but he didn't understand that. He was just doing that out of the kindness of his soul.
Yeah, my foundation, man, is based on homelessness. You know, I go to shelters, I eat in shelters, I hang out with homeless people. A lot of them people, man, love me out here, man, saying because of the things that I do and how I treat them. I don't feel like, okay, they better than me or I'm better than them. I want to try to, like, down the road to try to get a halfway house, man, you know, for homelessness. Because then when I go out and I ride buses and I trains and I see what I see, it hurts me, man. It's sad, man. So hopefully someday, man, I can get a halfway house and get the funds or something, man, to try to help back me up and help people like that. People that never committed a crime, that was on death row, bro. I have a friend named James Watson. He was upstate with me. He fought many, many years, you know, and because of they changed the law back then or the death penalty, that's what saved his life. He would have went to the chair if it wasn't for that. But now he's on the street.
Well, it never ceases to amaze and inspire me to see folks like you, Tyrone, who made it through hell and emerge carrying buckets of water to help those still stuck inside. And you want to do it on the outside too. So please let us know when you want to get that started and maybe we can raise support for it as well. And with that, we're going to go to closing arguments. First of all, I thank you both again, and then I'm going to switch my microphone off, kick back in my chair with my headphones on and close my eyes and just listen to anything else you want to share with me and our incredible audience. So, Neil, you go first, and then just hand the mic off to Tyrone, and he'll take us off into the sunset.
Yeah, so, I mean, I started working on Tyrone's case in 2002, and I've worked on it for over 20 years, and, you know, Tyrone's case really is sad, but it's also very inspiring to me in a lot of ways. You know, when I first met Tyrone, I had sort of a jaded view of people in prison and their stories. And I was very skeptical of individuals when they were told me they were innocent or they did not do something and the state had prosecuted them. But when I started listening to Tyrone and talking to Tyrone, I sort of realized what a genuine soul he was and what a good person he was. And despite having grown up in foster homes and despite not having a strong support system, he was a very genuine person. And he had never been really given a chance to succeed, unfortunately. And so when I started working on his case in 2002, I sort of committed to him that I would work as hard as I could to try to make his life better. And so for the past 20 years, I've worked with him both in our lawsuit against the parole board, in the criminal case with the DA, now helping him adjust to society after having served nearly 50 years in prison. While he has the right to be extremely angry, sad, and depressed about what happened to him, what I find inspiring about him is that he continues to have the same sort of affable, lovable soul that he had when I met him in 2002, and that he continues to sort of be a very nice human being. He really does care about the homeless. He really does care about people who have less than him. And Tyrone's case, while it is an indictment of the criminal justice system, and it is an indictment of how minorities were treated in Boston in the 1970s and 1980s, and even today, is really more about the will to survive and the will to be a nice person. And so that's why I continue to work hard for him and care about him genuinely.
I really appreciate being here doing this interview about my story, what happened to me, happened to the victim. I really appreciate what the victim did because I know that she didn't reach out to Ms. Thompson, and Ms. Thompson encouraged her to do what she did to come forward. I don't think that all this would have came about. So I just want to say to the victim, even though I never met her, I just want her to know I'm so appreciate it. I'm so happy that she came forward and helped me get out of prison. I probably wouldn't be here today. I know people had made bad comments after 50 years taken out of my life, but they don't really know really the circumstances behind really what happened in this case. And she was traumatized. So I just want the victim to know that I'm a man of God. I forgive her. I don't hate her. I hope, man, that her life is much, much better. No, I want her to know that I'm okay. I'm strong. I'm healthy. She did enough for me by helping me get out of prison. What she did was right, to tell the truth. I just want to know that I'm okay. I lost a lot, but I'm still here for a reason. She's still here for a reason. Everybody that lied back then, that testified back then on the Commonwealth side, in this case, is dead. So me and her is still here for a reason. I believe God saved her and saved me. And I believe that God touched her heart, man, to come forward, man, you know, and kept her alive. So I can be able, man, to walk out that prison. You know what I mean? So I just want to say to her, man, I appreciate you, miss. I hope you listening. And don't be afraid to reach out to my attorney if you want to ever want to get a chance to meet me in person or speak to me.
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction. You can listen to this and all the Lava for Good podcasts 1 week early by subscribing to Lava for Good Plus on Apple Podcasts. I want to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kathleen Fink, as well as my fellow executive producers, Jeff Kempler, Kevin Wardis, and Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production was supplied by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer, Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us across all social media platforms at Lava for Good and at Wrongful Conviction. You can also follow me on Instagram at It's Jason Flom. Wrongful Conviction is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
Hi, I'm John Hope Bryant, host of Money and Wealth on the Black Effect Podcast Network. I'm an entrepreneur and a businessman. Now, every Thursday, my newest venture is educating you on how to win financially. Even better, I'm going to teach it in a way that, well, you can understand. I'm going to meet you where you are and take you where you need to be. We all might have different starting points and end goals, but as long as we have the desire to acquire financial freedom, it can be done. Listen to Money and Wealth with John Hope Bryant every Thursday on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Rachel Levis, host of the new podcast, Rachel Goes Rogue. This podcast is about choosing my own path and standing in my power. I have been involved with one of the biggest scandals in reality television history. We're going to get into all of it, the good, the bad, the ugly. I've been keeping secrets for far too long, and I just want to come clean. Listen to Rachel Goes Rogue on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.